Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David Latulippe. Today you'll hear about the Cutting Ball Theatre's production of Henrik Ibsen's classic Hedda Gabler. The title character, Brittany Frazier, joins us along with director Yuri Ernoff and the Cutting Ball's artistic director, Paige Rogers. Dawson Dance SF is celebrating its 10th anniversary. I'll talk with musician Richard Howell and the titular head of the company, Gregory Dawson, about their collaboration on Les Vérités being offered at the Yerba Buena Center. Plus, sharpen your steak knives and chill that bottle of Chianti to get ready for the San Francisco premiere of Silence, the musical, the subversively funny and deliciously tasty musical parody of The Silence of the Lambs being served at the Victoria Theatre. Dr. Lecter and Clarice will be in studio and uncaged, by the way, Scott Hayes and Anne Norlin, respectively. Plus, contributor Peter Robinson will share his home cinema recommendations. Stay with us. A pleasure to welcome a somewhat ailing but ceaselessly innovative Paige Rogers back to our studio. Paige co-founded The Cutting Ball in 1999 with her husband Rob Melrose and is in her first full season as artistic director. She or her work as director has been seen all over the Bay Area, and she was in fact voted Best Actress in San Francisco for her role as Kate in Taming of the Shrew by the SF Weekly's annual readers poll. We talked last about the opening work of the Cutting Ball season, Avant-Garde-Rama. Welcome back, Paige.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
She's joined by director Yuri Ernoff, who was recently named one of American Theater Magazine's 7 Theater Workers You Should Know. We'll get to know him a little bit more today. Yuri graduated from the Russian Academy of Theater Art in 2000 and has directed over 40 productions in his home country of Russia, as well as in Europe and Africa, most recently for Cutting Ball, I believe, the memorable production of Alfred Jarry's Ubu Roy in 2014. Welcome to you, Yuri.
Thank you.
Our title character also joins us, Brittany Frazier, who was recently seen in the Cutting Ball's 2014 production of Superheroes. She's been seen throughout the Bay Area as actor, director, playwright, and teaching artist. Outside of Cutting Ball, she most recently performed with Campo Santo in Home and the SF Playhouse in All of What You Love and None of What You Hate. Welcome to you, Brittany.
Good afternoon. Good to be here.
Excellent to have you. Well, let's see. Paige, we've talked before about the provocative posters for this season. This one ranks right up there. This one has Hedda Gabler as a sort of rose pack with a big old cigar in her mouth. How did that concept come up?
Those are bright pink, fluorescent pink, and it's a close-up of Brittany's face, and she's holding a big cigar Brittany has absolutely stunning hands, so she could be a hand model. So her beautiful hand is up there holding this cigar, and you know, David, weirdly enough, the inspiration for all of our posters this season came from a show, the first Avant-Garde-Rama we ever did in 07. One of our graphic designers was at my house and talking to Rob about what he wanted for the poster, and my 4-year-old child, who's now 17 years old, was in the room chewing on a rubber lizard, and she picked up Rob's camera and just quickly took a snapshot of my daughter, and that is a sort of an iconic image that we use for all our Avant-Garde-Ramas. It's also on the big banners on the poles, and it's of this little cute blonde kid chewing on a lizard. And so we said, well, let's riff on that. And we got Brittany to do the cigar for Hedda Gabler, and then Courtney Walsh has a twisted strand of pearls that she has in her mouth for the other posters. So they
you
all
go, girl. That's some great imagery. It's very memorable.
Thank you. I like it.
So why did you choose Hedda Gabler for your second production as artistic director?
Well, for Ubu Roy, Rob had said to Yuri, oh, come direct something and maybe Paige can be in it. And I said, no, I just am not wanting to be on the stage so much anymore. I just want to direct. He said, oh, goody. Then I'll give the assignment to Yuri that he can direct Ubu Roy, which I just translated. And I said, but what, But hey, run it by Yuri. And so he sent it to Yuri, and Yuri said, "Sure, heck yeah, I'll direct this." This time I said, "Let's be kinder to the director." And so I said, "Yuri dear, how many plays do you want to send me that I could read and that you might want to direct?" And he sent a very interesting list of plays, and some of which my poor husband, when I said, "Do we have Yuri? What? Give me an example of one of the authors that you sent me."
What was that? I was sending you some Russian authors. I also was sending you this German stuff from the middle of the 20th century, which probably nobody knows here, and Swiss stuff, too. Uh-huh. Yeah, right.
But, David, the funny thing is Rob said, "We don't have those plays. We must get on Amazon immediately and order." So we did, and ordered all of them and read all of them, and then just talked to Yuri about, but Hedda was on his list.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, Yuri, Hedda Gabler, let's get a Ibsen 101 refresher, shall we, on not only Ibsen, but about this very important character.
Well, it's a wonderfully evil play, you know. I think it's, you know, it's dated, right? It's written in the end of the 19th century, so it, when you first read it, it feels dated. But then you find out that it's actually stronger than a lot of the contemporary plays you read. And then you think, what makes it so attractive? And I think what makes it so attractive is he's very masterfully exploring. Ibsen exploring the evilness in us, what makes us evil. He's kind of an, you know, anti-Chekhov. Chekhov also, you know, writes about those beautiful characters. Sort of evil, but mostly beautiful. Ibsen is writing about really bad people, you know? what makes it so masterful is that this evilness is very motivated, is very justified. They are evil for a reason. And their evilness from today's perspective is also kind of funny. You know, it's not the evilness of Auschwitz. It's not the evilness of the, you know, Second World War. It's the evilness of the late 19th century when the world still seems and feels to be a less evil place. So their evilness in comparison to today's values is kind of funny and is kind of a norm. Most of the evilness of these characters comes from them being very project oriented. You know, they are all people who are fighting for success in life, and that's what we all do now, right? So their evilness feels very close to our today's normality.
Are you updating it all? You mentioned it reads rather dated. Are you updating things somewhat or not?
Yeah, we cut half of that.
He did.
He cut half. Okay.
It went down from 120 to 60 pages. So you can get the concentrated Ibsen experience in 80 minutes, which I think is important.
All right. Well, we have the evil character with us.
She's right here.
Brittany Frazier. Brittany Frazier is in the title role of Hedda Gabler. Tell us about Hedda Gabler.
Hedda Gabler is a strong, vulnerable, opinionated, very caged, stuck character, I feel like. I'm trying my best in this role to bring out her vulnerability and also to make her relatable to people.
First encounter with Ibsen, or from school? Do you remember reading some stuff?
I remember reading Hedda Gabler at school at State, and just being blown away by the play and saying, "I have to do this play one day. I have to do it. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it."
All right, you grabbed that golden ring. Congratulations!
I did. Thank you.
That sounds great. Well, it really is considered one of the great dramatic roles in theater, and you mentioned it was on your list. What do you need for this role? What do you have to bring to the stage?
I think I have to bring vulnerability. I think I have to bring truth. And I think I just have to live moment to moment in the character, in the act. Because all four acts are different. Her journey is very different from act one to act four. And so just living in the moment and staying with the story and the characters and the struggle.
And Yuri, how have you helped Brittany bring out the darker side of Hedda?
Well, she has a revolver, she smokes, you know, she has all these horrible attributes of an evil woman, right? I think the beauty of the environment we're creating. I think it's very almost like, you know, candy beautiful environment. Helps to underline it. We brought a lot of songs about flowers, very funny songs about flowers into this play.
How is that tied in?
Yeah, you will come see. The whole thing is sort of a flower conservatory, and Hedda is a flower, which everybody is growing, right? So very Ibsen, I think, right?
Okay.
And then within this very fake and quote-unquote beautiful environment, a lot of very evil things are happening. So I think we were trying to create the contrast to that. We're trying to create a very pop cultural context, contrast to the very dramatic internals of the play.
Hmm. Now, if what we saw in Ubu Ra is any indication of an Arnav or Ernov style, we're going to be in for quite a treat here. But would you call this a more traditional staging of a classic work?
Well, Ubu is a crazier play on its own, right? But I don't think we're doing. Well, first of all, I don't really know what is a traditional performance. It's usually just, you know, people walking in sort of traditional costumes and not knowing what they're doing. So,
that's where you come in.
Yeah, right. I think whatever play we're doing, historic, contemporary, we're looking for something that is, to the extent relevant to where we are today, what we're doing today. Mm-hmm. And the text is certainly the big source, but it's also, you know, to the extent it's just the beginning of the journey. And talking of if we don't talk about us today, there are already not that many reasons for people to go to the theater. Why add another one? Mm-hmm. I think we're talking about contemporary people. We're talking about contemporary problems. What makes it interesting to me is that the things that felt so evil to Ibsen feel so normal to us.
Yeah, and to riff on something else that you said earlier, I went to a rehearsal where at the end of rehearsal, Yuri said to each character, he said, "So everybody has a very specific task that they're doing, something that they are working on, except for Hedda." And he went through each character, and each actor spoke up about what is their task, what is their purpose. And, you know, Brett, that made a deep impression on me, that each one has, even Thea has, helping to write the book and then helping to rewrite the book, and that Hedda is so lost without a task. She's the daughter of a general who was very, very lauded in their community, and her status is extremely high. She's an equestrian at a very high level, and a pianist. And there are things that Hedda has done that she's put a lot of time and effort into, and that she's very good at. But it's her brain, maybe it's her thinking that has not had the chance to have an outlet and a purpose like everyone else in the play. And it was very clear. Even the older lady, who's the aunt of Hedda's husband, she has a very clear purpose. She takes care of her sister. She minds her estate. She takes care of her nephew. Everyone has something very specific to do. And as Yuri says, now it's nearly plebeian, the way in which they are not supportive of one another in a way, and not able to just take a breather,
ladder to success. So
yeah.
So let's talk about the rest of the cast. We have our Hedda here. Who else is in the cast, and what are their motivations?
Yeah, Yuri, you take that.
Well, you started talking about Anjali. There are seven characters altogether, including Hedda in the play, and just reading off what they just said. Again, everybody's project is very specific and very, very ambitious, you know, in their own world. And one of their projects, I believe, is to keep Hedda with no project.
Mm.
I think that's kind of the central drama. Everybody wants Hedda to be there to probably, hopefully, give birth and sit there and do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, trying to define, part of that is, you know, part of the historical problematics of the play. It's defining the place of woman in the social structure. You know, you need to be beautiful, you need to wear beautiful things, you need to give a birth, and that's pretty much it. And I think that's one of the main things that Hedda is revolting from, of, you know, mm. of, from. Mm-hmm. And then the interesting thing, again, he's obviously, you know, I can say whatever, I can say dated, I can say whatever, but Ibsen is a brilliant playwright, right? So his dramatic structure, how he connects and interconnects characters is kind of amazing. Every character in the play has a full story. There's none of this other six are the supportive characters. Everybody, even including the maid, you know, mm-hmm. she has her interests and she has her line. And I think we have a brilliant cast for this to fulfill this.
That's Yuri Ernov directing Hedda Gabler at the Cutting Ball. Also talking with Paige Rogers, artistic director, and Hedda Gabler herself, Brittany Fraser. Brittany, so you got a lot of control in this play, don't you? You are the main event.
A lot of control. Yes, and she doesn't have a lot of control. I mean, she's controlled by her surroundings and the society and what women are supposed to do in that time period. And how she revolts against that is to act out as much as she can, to revolt against being a wife in the typical way a wife should act, against conforming to society, and just basically living her life, I guess, as freely as
she can
imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So after Hedda Gabler, what's always a dangerous question for an actor or actress? What's next?
I don't know.
There you go.
Britt's been booked for, like, constantly for a year and a half, and it's good that she has this little breather, because Hedda, a big seminal role like this will take the snuff out of you. And she basically has to carry the entire play on her shoulders. Mm. Yuri's set, by the way, David. I think
I was gonna ask
you're
going to
really like it. I'll admit, in front of Yuri, that I was dubious about it. So much so that we asked the set designer to make us a little model, because it just didn't seem like it would work. But it's, well, Yuri, you describe it. I'm not going to do it justice.
And the set designer
is Jacqueline Scott. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we were trying to build a flower conservatory, but it also needed to be a very flexible flower conservatory. So it's pretty much four moving frames that move enormous amount of times for in 1 hour 15 minutes. It's kind of a, you know, constructor. It's kind of, you can build plenty of things out of that. And audience is sitting on two sides. We're all very, very close. We're looking through the keyhole, which in our case are those small frames that are moving around. So,
and the frames move many, many times, even in the middle of a scene where people will come out and move them and the scene sort of lifts for a minute. And then what's interesting to me, and will be very interesting to any audience member, is to see what's the last formation of these four sort of cages and how does it relate to the very end of the play. Because I think, just Yuri, just snaps to you, I think it's quite imaginative and brilliant, and surprising. Even though you've seen those move around the whole time, you have no idea what's coming at the end. And then when it comes, you go, oh, I should have seen that coming. And yeah, really very innovative set construction and use of it. So, yeah.
Hedda Gabler opens tonight and runs through February 26th at the Cutting Ball. Information at cuttingball.com. Paige Rogers, Yuri Ernov, and Brittany Fraser, thanks so much for talking about the production, and I'm looking forward to seeing
you. David, come see you.
I definitely will.
Right.
Thanks
okay.
for coming.
Thank
out.
You
for having us.
Of course. Still to come, I'll be talking with Peter Robinson about some home theater ideas. You'll hear about Dawson Dance at the Ebbuena Center, and Silence the Musical, the musical parody of The Silence of the Lambs. Still to come here on Open Air. Thank you. That's the music of Richard Howell. He's collaborating once again with choreographer Gregory Dawson. The choreographer and founder of Dawson Dance SF, Gregory Dawson, joins me in studio to talk about their collaboration for the world premiere of the company's Les Vérités at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts next weekend. It's part of Dawson Dance SF's celebratory 10th anniversary season, featuring influential artists who have supported their craft. In addition to the live music by Richard, Les Vérités will also include the Revolution Quartet and Ron Curti, as well as visual media by John Ramirez. Gregory Dawson is a former Lines ballet dancer and formed Dawson Dance SF in 2007, hence the 10th anniversary. In addition to acclaimed work in Southern California and Denver, where he was named the best choreographer in Denver by the Denver Post, Greg currently teaches and choreographs for all the Lines Ballet educational programs. Greg, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Well, I was reading a bit about your collaborations with Richard and your collaboration Bird's Eye View, which you choreographed to Richard's music, and In the Moment, which went the other way around, where the dance came first and Richard provided music for the dance. Do either of you have a preference for the way you collaborate, or is it just a flip of a coin?
We don't have a preference. We were trying different things. I was trying different for myself, too, because I usually compose my own music. And he never worked with dance before, so either way would have worked for him. He's an improvisationalist, so, I mean, I think that he can just groove with anything. I'd like to also say that including the musicians on the show will be John Ramirez's son, Federico Ramirez, who will be playing the cello in some of the pieces. I mean, this particular project with Richard, I'm giving him free will because he's an improvisationalist. I mean, he likes to just riff and go at it as long as he knows what he's working with, which is different because I usually like to have control of everything. the first rehearsal was amazing, and it was just what I thought it would be.
So how many dancers are involved with the piece that Richard's playing?
Yeah, there are nine with this project. I usually only work with six. I like the chamber kind of smaller group because it challenges them and it challenges me as well.
Well, 10 years is a tremendous accomplishment. Take us back to your final days with Alonzo Lines and why you decided to form your own dance company.
Haha. Brilliant question. After retiring, I just went to Alonzo's office and said, okay, I'm tired, you know. I'm going to go off to Italy. I'm fluent in Italian. I studied at university. I had a home there, and I'm a mosaicist as well. I studied mosaics in Ravenna. And I went away and came back. This was after our last tour in the at the Biennale in Venice. I came back home. I had the conversation with Alonzo. The following month, he said to me, you're going to be teaching and choreographing for the BFA program that we're starting. I was like, oh, really? Okay. You know, I never considered myself a teacher, never considered myself a choreographer, although I come from a family of teachers. I got into the studio, started working with the students, realized immediately that, you know, this was something that was natural for me, and I felt most comfortable with it. I've always been a giver. My parents taught me that way. I also realized subsequently afterwards that he all alone was cultivating a choreographer. So that summer he said, I need for you to get some dancers together and go down to Southern California because the company cannot go down to Southern California to a state program. And I subsequently got the dancers together and we went down, and hence Alonzo gave birth to my company.
Nice. Well, you mentioned Southern California. You came to San Francisco to study Italian. How did dance get involved in your life?
I originally am from Chicago. I went to university at Southern Illinois at Edwardsville. At Edwardsville, there was a really wonderful Italian program. But there also was a dance program. I was also studying dance in Chicago at the same time at Ruth Page. But in that program was an amazing dancer, Catherine Dunham. She saw that I had ballet technique, and understood that I needed to leave the university because I had advanced so much in my Italian that I needed to go to a larger program, which was San Francisco State. She also said to me that, well, did you know there's this really phenomenal teacher there? His name is Alonzo King. And I went, oh, that's great, you know. And then there's also Vaganova teacher there, so you can study with her as well in Berkeley at Charles Anderson, Evelyn Sheward. And got there and met Alonzo, and it was just like the gates, heavenly gates opening up. It was an amazing experience.
Yeah. Neat, neat. Well, let's take us back to Chicago for a line I read in your biography. You're one of 14 kids raised in Chicago by parents who were insistent that everyone get into college education.
Oh, yeah. My mother was adamant about it. We grew up in the south side of Chicago, 44th and Kings Drive. It was very strange because I went to an elementary school, which was Mollison Elementary School. And most of us went to that school. And my family grew up in this particular neighborhood. And my mother was an aide there, a teacher's aide there, and she subsequently became kindergarten. And, I just didn't know why we were all going to this school. But I did know that when I walked into that school door, there was this huge picture on the wall. His name was Irvin C. Mollison, who is the school was named after this guy. Years later, many years later, I found out that that was my grandmother's brother. And that I come from a family who was thought that education was most important.
Well, I'm the youngest of seven, and where do you fall in the line
12.
Of 14?
I'm the 12th child. Yeah, I mean, there was never a dull moment. My mother was very physical.
Very pregnant for a very long time.
Yeah. Baseball, she played everything with us. I mean, we did everything together. I mean, the family was really important. The house, my house was the house on the block. Everybody was at our house. My parents invited anyone in because, you know, they knew how important it was to be loved and to love.
Nice. Talking with Gregory Dawson, founder of Dawson Dance. Their 10th anniversary offering is at the Yerba Buena Center next weekend, next Friday and Saturday at 8 p.m. Now, what distinguishes your particular style of choreography? I know you emphasize your collaboration with live music, which is fantastic. But what says, that's Gregory's work?
Well, it's really physical, really, really, really physical. I like to think of it as being simplistic, but it really isn't because it's kind of quite complicated. I try to amalgamate, you know, my culture, my experiences in life with the ballet technique. I don't always work in the narrative. I like to consider myself an inventor. You know, I'd like to explore and go deeper with the work. I'm really interested in the dancers coming in from the inside out, this truth that really resonates. I'm purity. I shy away from fake or contrived cliché.
Uh-huh. Well, your press materials also said that you envision choreography as a process by which artists transform themselves, audiences, and the world of dance that surrounds us.
And I feel that if they come from that place of where I speak, it shows. It just really shines. When I'm in the studio working with them, there are many times where I don't actually set choreography in my brain and then go in and spew it out to them. I will go into the studio, we will sit and talk, and then I will start moving. And they will interpret that movement. And oftentimes, it's better than what I've envisioned it to be. And I think that giving them that freedom to do that elevates the art form, elevates the voice of the company, elevates themselves, elevates the art form.
Mm. I have to give you some kudos for the incredible visuals at your website, DawsonDanceSF.org. Not only fantastic choreographic moments captured and still, but some really amazingly creative costumes going on.
Thank you. That's Jamie Emmerich. I'm the family guy. Like I really like when I'm close to people, I really want to be close to them. She lived right across. She lives right across the street from me. Lived. I moved subsequently. She has a really beautiful eye. The photography is Devi Pride from Santa Cruz, who is amazing as well. And I have a really technician that I've known for many, many years, Scott Pascal, who builds the site, and he was a dancer, so he kind of understands movement. I like to think that the work appears in a cinematic way. Like you see the work, and it's as if you're looking at a movie, you know. And then you'll have your own interpretation of that, you know. I'm very grateful that, you know, people don't have the same interpretations that I do, because when they come up with something very different, it really, I mean, I say to them, I would have never thought of that before, because, you know, it just seems so far-fetched, but it, in essence, is beautiful, you know.
Mm. Gregory, fluent in Italian, incredible choreographer. You mentioned mosaicist. Now, what sort of things are you doing in the mosaic world?
Well, I don't have time to do that anymore. I mean, every now and then I will go to. I still have my studio. It's full of costumes, but there is still a Hammer, a Hardy, and a, you know, a stand there to work with, and it's full of Smalti and Tessera. You know, I find even when I was performing, I would do it, but when I had retired, I needed, you know, to focus and to go in and figure out, okay, I'm not dancing anymore, and what am I going to do? And I've always known that I would be some kind of artist of some form, because I went to the Art Institute of Chicago, too. The same uncle that paid for my ballet training paid for me to go to the Art Institute of Chicago.
And his number's what?
So, I mean, you know, it's just patience, you know. It's like meditation. You just really have to understand that it's not going to appear in one day. It's going to take 1 year or 1 month.
Congratulations, Gregory Dawson, on 10 years of Dawson Dance. DawsonDanceSF.org. Live collaborations with saxophonist Richard Howell, as well as the Classical Revolution Quartet, Ron Curti, John Ramirez and his son, I understand. Jamie Emmerich, set design, and Joan Raymond on costumes. It's at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts on Howard Street next Friday and Saturday at 8. Again, DawsonDanceSF.org for more information. Gregory, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me again.
Make it this far in so little time. Look in the car, there's a head in a jar. It's the scene of a crime. Now they can't hold me back, cause I just raised the bar. I'm on fire, call the press. Here I am, hold your breath, I'm a star. It's Agent Starling. Riddles and anagrams, oh how he thrives on his cute little games. Don't really mind at the end of the day if he's giving me names. And now that I'm making a difference, the guys won't belittle me back at the base. Guess it's a good thing that multiple MIGs shot a load in my face. Crawford's rewarding me, now I'm officially part of the chase. All of you bastards had better keep up, cause I'm setting the pace. I'm excited, I confess, won't my teachers be impressed? I'll be Quantico's little darling. There are lives on the line, and that shepherd had to shine, that this case should be mine. It's Agent Starling.
A little taste, so to speak, of Silence, the musical. Cloud Nine Theatricals, in association with Lang Entertainment Group and Ray of Light Theater, proudly present the San Francisco premiere of Silence, the musical, the unauthorized parody of The Silence of the Lambs, playing a limited engagement at San Francisco's Victoria Theater on 16th Street, Thursday the 26th through Saturday, February 25th. It tells the story of rookie FBI agent Clarice Starling as she matches wit with the brilliant but insane cannibal Dr. Hannibal Lecter in order to catch the serial killer known as Buffalo Bill. Clarice faces her own demons and a troop of singing and dancing lambs while racing against the clock to unlock Lecter's clues before another innocent girl is killed and skinned by Buffalo Bill. Scott Hayes as the good doctor has appeared in Where Is Charlie and Sugar for 42nd Street Moon, Christmas with the Crawfords, Lincoln Center in Napa, Women Behind Bars, Wellfleet Harbor Actors Theater, and in other places in Provincetown and other environs, as his alter ego Norman Vane, cabaret artiste and bon vivant. He can often be seen at Martini's here in San Francisco and was voted best comedic cabaret performer of 2013. Scott, a pleasure to welcome you to Open Air.
Hello there.
And Norland as Clarice recently relocated to the Bay Area from Washington, D.C. Some of her favorite roles include Mary Magdalene and Jesus Christ Superstar, Lucy in the Threepenny Opera, among others. She teaches middle school language arts and arts classes at the Stratford School in San Francisco here.
Shout out.
Yay! And directs children's theater productions, most recently The Phantom Tollbooth Jr., Honk Jr. for Bay Area Children's Theater, who we've had here often, and You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. Nice to have you on as well, Anne.
Thank you so much.
Clarice, nice to have you.
Thank you, sir.
Well, let's talk about your character, Clarice. And how much does this... For people that are familiar with the movie, are they just going to laugh out loud with your characterization? Parody.
Absolutely. it's been a really fun process figuring out how to make it totally straight, like playing every, you know, moment just the way Jodie Foster does in such seriousness while utter chaos ensues around me, including singing and dancing lambs and just joke after joke, and just I'm so focused on the case. I'm so focused. Yes. She's making a shoot.
And obviously Jodie Foster being a big inspiration for the character.
Absolutely. I love Jodie Foster. Holy moly.
You've got the look going on there too. I don't think any corrective surgery was done, but you got Jodie Foster down pat.
Yeah, with the black wig, you can. When they first saw me, it was like, "Whoa, it's Jodie."
Dr. Lecter, tell us about your characterization and parodization of.
Well, I mean, if you watch the movie a few times, you see it's in a way it's kind of already over the top. So like Anne said, the challenge is to play it straight, and it seems. The more serious you take it, the funnier it seems to be, just because the story is ludicrous, you know, to begin with, you know. I mean, this guy's skinning women, and this other guy's, like, getting into the mind of this poor, you know, rather innocent FBI agent, you know, so.
Right, and she's got to solve the case to get the lambs to stop screaming.
Right.
Obviously.
And in this show, the lambs literally are screaming, you know.
Screaming, singing, and dancing, I understand.
Yeah.
And they play multiple roles. We have an incredibly talented cast of, they're playing all sorts of roles, and they're in lamb hooves, so.
They're all amazing. I mean, they some of them go from one character to another in, like, a second and a half. They're just the most incredible group of people.
The music is by John and Al Kaplan, a pair of brothers who are also comedy writers. They created musical parodies of other films and TV shows, including various Arnold Schwarzenegger films, such as Conan the Barbarian, Predator, and Commando. Those must be interesting to hear as well. And they scored and co-wrote the film Zombievers in 2014. It's being called, it makes those naughty ditties in the Book of Mormon seem like trunk songs dropped from The Sound of Music.
So true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, they're
catchy tunes.
There's one particular song that we cannot repeat the title on the radio.
Several, actually.
Yeah.
Well, that brings us to, you know, who should come to this? Is this definitely an R-rated production for people that are listening now to consider to hire a babysitter and come themselves?
As a sixth grade teacher myself, I would say, yes, hire that babysitter and then come out and, you know, have your glass of wine and then come see the show. And then stay for the 10 p.m. show. So that you can really soak it all in.
That's the one that's all in the nude, right?
Right. That's the version we do, what? Totally naked. Sorry, I just learned this today.
My contract didn't say that.
Yeah.
So there actually is some Chianti being served, is there?
I was told, I don't know if it's still on, but I was told around beginning rehearsal that they would be selling it in the lobby. But, you know.
Steak knives optional.
You know. You know, and then probably fava beans, and, you know, I'll take care of the rest.
Indeed, Clarice.
Yes.
Nice, nice. So tell us about these lambs that are dancing about and telling the story.
Boy, will we. We have Brian Watson as Buffalo Bill. He is the imitation down so well, but he's also transferring from being a lamb and Buffalo Bill.
Now we're the only two in the cast who play one character.
They're schizophrenic lambs.
Yeah, the rest of them are just like they're lambs in one moment, and the next moment they're a prison guard or you know a senator or.
Brendan North as who is Chilton, Dr. Chilton. He has a quick change where he's behind a desk. And then the clothes are somehow on the desk, and he's a reporter or a newscaster. And he's just like, and a squirrel fashion show, you know, whatever. It's just so fast. And I think Jason Hoover is taking advantage of his flexibility, our director, to just make him do all sorts of crazy switches and changes.
There's a lot of clever things just with the way certain roles are cast. Like, for instance, the main victim of Buffalo Bill, Catherine, the same actress also plays her mother, the senator, which is like really, really, I think, a brilliant idea. And it works really well in this. You know, it's very funny.
That's neat. Mm-hmm.
And Alex Rodriguez, our choreographer, has just a really wonderful way of incorporating lambisms into their... you know, into the movements, like when you see a lamb dancing, excuse me, and they sort of like flop like a fish almost. I don't know how to even describe it. They're excited like a lamb.
And they've all given each other, for rehearsal, they've all given each other lamb names. Like one of them is Angela Lambsberry.
That was my idea.
Oh,
I'm just taking credit.
One's hoof fell off during rehearsal the other night, so now he's a lamputee.
Lamputee.
Yes. We also have Wiggle Butt.
Wiggle, yeah. Well, we won't talk about him.
He's
all right.
He's the naughty one.
The naughty sheep, the black sheep, so to speak, of the music. Talking with Scott Hayes as Dr. Hannibal Lecter and Anne Norland as Clarice Starling in Silence, the musical, the subversively funny and deliciously tasty award-winning musical parody at the Victoria Theatre, which opens on 26th of this month. Silence the Musical, sf.com for more information. One of the other tunes that sounds familiar, at least from what I saw in the movie, is Quid Pro Quo, Clarice. Mm-hmm. What is this tune? Tell us about what we're going to hear.
That's our big duet where we make the deal. You know, if she'll tell me things about her, I'll tell her things about Buffalo Bill. And it's a big tango number.
It's a big tango,
Big tango.
Yeah.
A lot of tango. You know?
From Silence the Musical, Quid Pro Quo. Scott, Anne, thanks for coming in. We wish you a terrific run.
Thank you so much.
Quid Pro Quo. I need an answer. Is it yes or no? Quid pro quo. You better give me what I want or go. And don't you lie to me or else I'll know. Quid pro quo.
Daddy died. He was a cop and I was oh so young.
Poor girl. Was he shot? Oh boy, that sounds like fun.
Don't get cute or else that's it, we're done.
I can make you eat your tongue. Quid pro quo.
So I moved away to live on my cousin's ranch.
Did the rancher molest you?
Unlike someone, he was a very decent man.
Quid pro quo, Clarice.
Heard a scream one night and I ran downstairs.
Interesting. Are you sure the rancher didn't inspect your pubic hair?
Yes, quid pro quo. I kept my hand up and it's your turn now. Time is short. I gotta catch him. Won't you tell me how? Tit for tat. Tell me why are all the victims fat?
What could be his reasoning? You control poor Catherine's fate.
All good things to those who wait.
Gotta tell me who he is.
You've been good, old Grancho Witch.
What would make him want to remove their skin?
Come, Clarice, and throw me with all your acumen.
Bugs inside their throats, Dr. Cammy Wack.
Transformation just like a pretty butterfly. Billy wants to change as well. Staten Island sure sounds swell. Everything's within your reach. Time to frolic on a beach.
Quid pro quo. Do I let this creep inside my head? If I don't, Catherine Martin is as good as dead. I'll be the laughing stock of all the feds.
Quid pro quo. You'll paint a picture of your troubled youth. Quid pro quo. I want your nightmares, not my little sleuth. Share with me the naked truth. Hurry up, you're way too slow.
Who is she? I gotta know.
Sodomy fellatio. Now I like my quid pro quo.
Quid pro quo from Silence, the musical. You heard there from the off-Broadway recording Brent Barrett and Jen Harris. On the production here in San Francisco, Scott Hayes takes on the role of Hannibal Lecter, and the talented and lovely, almost a double for Jodie Foster, Anne Norlin will be handling the role of Clarice Starling. It begins this Thursday, the 26th of January, at the historic Victoria Theater here in San Francisco. Information at silencethemusicalsf.com.
Happen in a show. You can make them laugh, you can make them cry. Anything, anything can go. The clown with his pants falling down, or the dance that's a dream of romance, or the scene where the villain is mean. That's entertainment.
Entertainment indeed, with our regular contributor, Peter Robinson, offering some home viewing ideas. Hi, Peter.
Hi, David. Good to be here. And, yeah, well, I'm thinking of That's Entertainment because the last 2 weeks, particularly in Marin and the East Bay, we have had rain. And rain means, for me anyway, having to stay at home and find out not what's happening on the silver screen, the big screen with those stereophonic sounds, but on the small screen, either via Netflix, Acorn TV, or starting this last Sunday, PBS Masterpiece Theatre. And what has begun is the beginning of a 7-part series, very British, very costume drama, and it is called Victoria. And it is the story of Queen Victoria as a teenage girl who comes to power in 1837 and, in fact, will rule the British Empire, never mind just England, for the next 6 decades. So I think this is an interesting piece of social history. It's an interesting piece of constitutional history. And at the same time, I've mentioned the word costume. It is a costume drama set very much in the mid-19th century. And at the same time, it is filled with palace intrigue, since they believe that the young queen needs guidance. The young queen, on the other hand, has a mind of her own, and that does not include old men telling her how to do it. So I think it's a reflection on what it means to be a constitutional monarch, because that means that you are a figurehead for the country. At the same time, you rule in conjunction with the two houses, the House of Lords and the House of Parliament. House of Commons and the House of Lords constitute the nature of parliamentary government. The Queen is played by Jenny Coleman, and I should add, this comes very quickly on last year's The Crown, which was a Netflix production. It actually won 2 Golden Globes. And while this may have less elaborate sets, it deals seriously with an important part of the history. So as the young queen ascends to the throne, she is guided by Lord Melbourne. Lord Melbourne is played by Rufus Sewell, and he acts as both a teacher and advisor. And it's pretty obvious that she has a bit of a crush on him. And she doesn't like the leader of the opposition, who happens to be Sir Robert Peel. And she thinks that she can decide on government instead of letting the constitution run. So we have a setup which begins very much upstairs, but also, a bit like Downton Abbey, it has a downstairs story. We see the scullery maid, the cook, we see the chef, and we have everything that happens below the stairs. A little imitative, in this case, of what I call Downton Abbey. Now, I've mentioned it's a 7-part series. There's still time to tune in. It runs for the next 6 weeks. And I think anyone who wants to see really top BBC actors performing in that kind of understated way that brings Masterpiece Theatre its reverence, and I think that's probably the best word, you will enjoy the unfolding story of how this young 18-year-old monarch finally came to be the second longest ruling queen in the British Empire, and in fact only exceeded today by Queen Elizabeth II, who recently has already passed her 90th birthday. So for people who like Masterpiece Theatre, that's a top recommendation. Now, if you dial around your clock, there is a small but a useful catalogue put out by Acorn TV. And again, they have a lot of, in this case, BBC or British drama. And there's a new series which has just begun called Jericho of Scotland Yard. And this is very much a detective story. The lead is played by Robert Lindsay. And for people who remember Foyle's War, this has moved the story forward to the 1950s. And Jericho is one of these mixed blessings. He has a mind of his own. He doesn't fit into the police world. At the same time, he's a top detective. And I think the scenes in London, particularly in the 1950s, were extremely realistic. People may not remember this, but the original phrase, a pea souper, was introduced by Conan Doyle in Sherlock Holmes. Well, in the 1950s, London was saturated with smog or heavy fog. And this, of course, meant tracing down detectives in the mist. It's an interesting story. It's got a lot of local references to events in the 1960s. 1950s. So in terms of being a period piece, again, interesting to see, interesting to watch. The title of the series is called Jericho of Scotland Yard. It's produced by Acorn TV. And if you're in on a rainy evening and you want a chase police movie, here's your opportunity to see something done in style, and certainly done, in my opinion, with authenticity. And so as the rain continued, I then started switching my dial, and I came up with an interesting courtroom drama, this time set in Australia, and it's called Janet King. She plays the role of a barrister, which is the British or the Australian equivalent of a trial attorney. And again, it comes in 6 different episodes. The main actress, Marta Disseldorp, is the leading attorney, and again, it's intriguing to see how a different legal system plays out in what, in effect, is a mystery. Again, if you want a background on Australia, there are some great shots of Sydney. You see Sydney Harbour, you see the famous Opera House, you see the streets, and then it switches to Melbourne. So you get a sense of geography, a sense of travel, and the series is called The Enemy Within. The key character is known as Janet King, which the actress who appears in each and every of the series. So if the rain is getting you down, don't despair. While I'm a great believer in going to the theatre, by that I mean the movie theatre, because I feel you see the movies undistracted and you see them focused and on the distance from either the telephone or the cell phone. If you need to stay at home, Three recommendations for this week. One is Victoria, put out by PBS, the new Masterpiece Theatre series. The second is Jericho of Scotland Yard, another bloodhound on the trail. And finally, an interesting Australian series called Janet King, known as The Enemy Within. And so that's a combination of PBS, Acorn TV, and Netflix. Highly recommended, and another way of staying dry and still enjoying a good movie.
Indeed. Thanks so much, Peter, for those recommendations. They're on my short list as well.
Okay, good to be here, and I'm still dry, believe it or not.
We'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
Okay.
A couple of interesting musical birthdays today, including the great conductor Simon Rattle, who we're hearing in the background conduct the finale of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, born on this date in 1955. Also shares a birthday with Janis Joplin, the great Janis Joplin. Dolly Parton and Robert Palmer also share this birthday, along with our very dear friend Charles Amerkanian, composer and director of Other Minds, music from Other Minds heard on Friday evenings at 11 here on KALW. Happy birthday, Charles. Our shows on open air are archived at kalw.org. If you got a show segment suggestion, send me an email, david@kalw.org. And my thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing the show. Tune in next week.